This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 2016, Bobby Cavnar was North Carolina's Teacher of the Year. This year, he was named the nation's best teacher by the NEA Foundation. Mr. Cavnar is a British literature teacher at Gaston County's South Point High School in Belmont. Somehow, he makes what many might consider a very dry, distant subject come alive for his students, and that's because of his passion for teaching. Unlike some recipients of Teacher of the Year awards, he has not been lured away from the classroom, much to the benefit of his students, particularly, and public education in general. He points out that many of society's great artists, great thinkers, inventors, came from less than ideal circumstances. In today's world, it is the public education system that offers those students a chance. We spoke with Bobby Cavnar on this program 2 years ago when he was this state's Teacher of the Year, and we are pleased to welcome him back today for a conversation about education, about what it is, what it could be. And in a world so focused on education only as a conduit to jobs, how arts and humanities education play a role in preparing young people to understand others and the world we live in, and how that too plays a role in preparing a better workforce. Bobby Cavnar, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm sure folks listening to this might have some comments or questions of you. You can join us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. That's email. Or search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. And you can also watch us on Facebook Live. This latest award is another in a series of awards for you. And if you were an actor, you'd be an EGOT. Do you know what that is?
No.
An EGOT is somebody who has won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. All the big awards. This year you were Teacher of the Year. The year that you were Teacher of the Year in North Carolina, 2016, you were also North Carolina State's Inspirational Teacher of the Year, Gaston County Schools Teacher of the Year, and the 2016 Southwest Region Teacher of the Year. And at that time, a 5-time recipient of South Point High School's Most Inspirational Educator Award, which is voted on
by students.
Yeah. Wow. This, you make this seem easy, is it?
No, not if you do it right.
And what does that mean, doing it right?
Teaching is always hard. That it looks easy from the outside, I think, like most jobs, probably, like your own job. And if you do it well, it looks easy, but it's never been easy, and it never gets any easier if you're doing it right, because every year is different. Every year you get a new group of students in there, and you have to discover who they are and what they need and what their goals are, and then how to tailor what you do to meet those.
Isn't their goal, since you teach British literature and probably a few other things, but I mean, isn't their goal, the student's goal, just to learn the material and take the test?
Sure. Yeah, when they walk in, their goal is to jump through whatever hoops I put in front so they can move on to whatever it is they really want to do.
So when you say you have to learn your students and find out, obviously, what makes them tick so that you can communicate to them effectively, but you also talked about learning their goals.
Right.
Outside of passing your tests, what are their goals? Well, what should be their goals?
That's interesting. They don't always know. They have often been through years and years of school and classes always looking at something else, something further on, going, well, I got to finish high school, so maybe I can get into college. And then I just got to finish college so I can get. And then ultimately they come out at the end and may realize, oh, I was always looking for something else beyond that and wasn't paying attention to what I was doing then. And so, you know, it's something that they have to figure out as they go through, and I'm trying to help them figure it out now before it's too late. Like, what are your goals? What is it you want? What is it you want to do?
We should probably mention that you teach AP courses.
I do. I teach courses. AP.
Would the same be true of young people who aren't ready for AP courses?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've not always taught AP. I actually started my career in Florida and then came here about 15 years ago now, and you know, worked my way up in the department and all that. But everyone, no matter whether they're college bound or not, has some goal that they want to achieve, some ultimate life that they want to live. And often they don't know how it is you get there, but that's our job as public education, is to figure out, well, how can we help you get there? What is it you want?
So you've been North Carolina Teacher of the Year. You've been the Regional Teacher of the Year. You are now the nation's best teacher, according to the NEA. Well, no, so tell me what you think.
Yeah.
What do you think sets you apart? How is your approach different from those people who are not the teacher of the year?
Oh, that's a tough one. I keep sort of blushing every time someone says nation's best teacher, because the truth is, just in my one school, I know 10 teachers who are phenomenal teachers and would absolutely give me a run for my money. The issue is obviously that I got noticed. I was first my school's teacher of the year, and then I got noticed again because of that, and then got noticed again. And so I end up being the one who made it to the top. But I'm really representative of great public school educators all over the
state.
How
subjective is it? I mean, how does one become either the North Carolina Teacher of the Year or be recognized as the nation's best teacher? Do you put yourself up? Does your principal put you up?
Actually, in North Carolina, it's a competitive process. You start as your school's Teacher of the Year, and that's voted on by the faculty. Mm-hmm. And then in my district, you then go through a series of interviews, and they choose five of the 52 school teachers of the year. They chose five through the interview process. And then you write a series of essays on everything from classroom practice to public policy. And then they come and actually observe you teaching, and they interview your faculty, they interview students, they interview parents, and they choose one. And that's how I became District Teacher of the Year. And it's the same process all the way through to the end. And you're competing, first with 52 and then with, eight different regions, and eventually you're competing basically with the 100,000 teachers in North Carolina.
I'm sure that every day, every class is different.
Oh, yeah.
But if we dropped in, if our entire listening audience could drop in right now on your classroom and you were teaching, what would we see?
The first thing you would notice is my classroom. My classroom has become sort of the focus of a lot of attention, because it's a very unique room. It's I always joke that there are no Garfield posters on the wall. There's no puppy who hates Mondays, and there's it's a very unique room. It's built a lot like a Victorian library. There are old clocks and lampposts, and there's big comfy chairs, and there's books absolutely everywhere. Every leather-bound book I could find in every antique store I just bought up. And so it's sort of dusty and old. And I think when you walk in, you get that instant feeling of, oh, this is someplace serious. This is someplace academic, And but it's also very well lit and warm and inviting. And but when you come in, that's the way I teach as well. It's an atmosphere that I create, and the kids, every year I'm shocked they love it. I really am, because I love it. I built it for myself. I built it because I love that feeling, and every year they love it too.
It's shocking. Tell me what you teach. I know you teach British literature.
Right.
What does that
mean? In chronological order, it starts with Beowulf, in Old English.
Well, they're right there. You lost me right there.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking, how can high school kids in the 21st century like Beowulf?
Beowulf is magnificent. I mean, if you've watched Game of Thrones, you know why Beowulf is a hit.
Yes, but you can understand Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So come to my class and you'll understand Beowulf, I promise.
Right.
But it's we start with Beowulf and the kids love it. It's dragons and Vikings and it's war, and it lasts. It's a wonderful story. It really is. And when we go through the Canterbury Tales, which is just some of the funniest, most irreverent, dirty humor you could imagine in the medieval period. Mm-hmm. And then we get into my very favorite thing, which is William Shakespeare, and the kids just love it. They eat it up. We perform Shakespeare. We do a lot of performance interpretation. Shakespeare is theater. It's not just this text.
How come they don't freeze up at the thought of having to stand up in front of their fellow students?
Well, by that point, they've been in my class for about 6 weeks, and they've learned to sort of trust each other, trust me. The way I tell them this from the very first day is I embarrass myself far more than they will ever. One of the very first things I do on the first day is show them my senior high school picture. I had long, long hair and pierced ears, and I was very moody. I was trying to be Eddie Vedder. I show them that, and I say, this is what I looked like in high school. And they laugh, and they joke, and they go, wow, what a fool. And that's perfect, because from that point on, they trust, okay, I can take a chance in here. Okay. And so it really is about establishing relationships with kids every single year. And I start by embarrassing myself before they ever can.
So you go from Beowulf through Shakespeare to what?
Yeah. Well, we'll go through all the way into the Victorian age. We often read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go all the way through, current literature.
Frankenstein's good. I liked Frankenstein.
Oh yeah, Frankenstein's a great story. Yeah, it's great. I mean, these are relevant things. Things like Frankenstein. That's one of the keys is making your curriculum relevant right. to what's happening today. And they see it all around them with the rise of, robots and Google Home. It's that you have these devices in your pocket that are technology that can be very destructive, and it can seriously harm you emotionally as well as physically, and so these are things they understand when you see, okay, well, science has created this thing that it can't control and that is destroying people's lives. They associate with that.
When you were on the show in 2016, you said that you wished there was something you could, quote, bottle or use to train every teacher in North Carolina, but the teaching is dynamic and changes moment to moment and kid to kid. And today's public education system, as we've come to learn on this program, and many times we've talked about this, is that things have been homogenized and standardized, and teachers have to get to a certain place at a certain right. time so that the tests can be passed by the students because they're standardized tests.
Right.
And in that environment, how can you do what it is that you do, light a fire under these kids in the way only you can because you love the material?
I've asked myself that a lot in the last 2 years because I think you're right that we are heading more and more and more towards standardization and this idea that, oh, well, there is a single best practice, and if we just figure out what that is and they can pass that test. And I often say we've gotten to the point that if it's not countable, it doesn't seem to count.
Right.
It has to be measurable. We have to be able to figure out exactly. But what I've found is that despite that, if you build those relationships and you teach well and you teach dynamically and you get buy-in from kids and you get them excited about the material, the tests take care of themselves. The tests will take care of itself if you're teaching
you know
that,
but do the
well.
People above you know that in Raleigh?
Not
in
always,
Washington.
But that's my job.
Because yeah. I look, thinking back on high school, I had some incredibly good teachers in mm-hmm. high school. I was really fortunate. Great history teacher, great political science teacher, great French teacher, great English teacher. I mean, the English teacher that I had, I probably told the story on the air once before. Sophomore English, we came in, we had to read a book. We read the book, we had to write a report. We wrote the report. She handed it back. We all got Fs. And she said, you're going to write this again because of this, that, and the other thing. Write it again. We came back in. We turned in the report. She turned it back. We all got Fs. She said, it's clear to me that you cannot write. So this is supposed to be American literature this, mm-hmm. this semester. No, we're going to diagram sentences the entire semester. Best thing that ever happened to me. She couldn't do that today, could she?
It depends. So what you're describing is a teacher who looked at what the needs of her students were.
Right.
And then met those needs. And that's what I've been talking about. There, every year, I do not teach the exact same thing. I look at what the needs of my students are and meet those.
Bobby Kavnar is our guest. He is the recipient of the NEA Member Benefits Award for Teaching Excellence, the best teacher in the nation. We'll come back with more in a moment. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Bobby Kavnar, the 2016 North Carolina Teacher of the Year and now the best teacher in the nation for 2018. He teaches British literature, and I believe you are the chair of the English department, if I'm not mistaken. Is that still
right?
True?
Mm-hmm.
At South Point High School in Belmont, which must be a good school if there are others that you say are as good or better than you in the teaching ranks out there at South Point.
Oh, yeah. I traveled over the last year or so to, dozens, if not even hundreds of schools. And in every single one of them, I've met magnificent teachers from elementary all the way through high school, just amazing teachers. I learned so much from the teachers that I visited this year, or over the last 2 years, actually. And it's really humbling because I realized there was so much that I could learn and so much I could make better in my own teaching.
What attracted you to teaching in the first place?
It wasn't my original plan when I started college. I loved English. I loved it in high school and I loved it in college. And I thought, well, I want to major in English and I'll figure out what to do with that as I go. And
because your father wanted you to be a doctor.
Oh, he wanted to be a lawyer. Yeah,
lawyer,
pre-law.
Excuse me,
yeah, he was convinced I'd be a lawyer. His entire philosophy was that your goal in life should be to give back to society, to sustain society by doing something that makes us all better.
Have we lost that? I've heard so many people from that generation say that.
Yeah.
Including the Kennedys. I mean, that was John Kennedy, I think, said that, or Robert Kennedy said that you have to give back. Have we lost that? The kids today believe that.
I hope so. I meet kids every day who do. It's hard to say what do kids think, because every child
they're
is different.
Yeah.
Every single one of them. But also, you have to remember, they're kids. I think if you had asked me when I was 15,
right,
I probably would not have the view I have today at 40. It's
Well, why do you feel that way? Just because your dad said you have to give back? So
no,
you went into teaching so you could give back?
I think I went into teaching at first because I got to teach one class period at Florida State. They have a high school on campus. And I took an intro to education course and thought, well, let me try that out. And I taught one class.
And you were 19, I believe.
I was about 19 years old, and I absolutely loved it. I loved every second of it. Talking to teenagers about poetry, and they weren't much younger than I was at the time, and talking to them about poetry and seeing them get excited, I thought, oh, that's me. I loved that, and I was really excited about it. And so I would love to say I had this grand drive from the very beginning, and it wasn't true. I just loved it, and I developed over time a sort of appreciation for public schooling and public education and the value of it. But you know, kids are going to be kids. They're worried about their own things when they're kids, and I think that's something that we as adults can cultivate in them.
Do you ever have kids who don't love it? Life does not go on.
Of course, and that is the challenge of every day. Every day's challenge is to look at your class, and sometimes that's 35 faces at a time, and to look at them and see who isn't here with me, who isn't buying in, who isn't getting it, or who doesn't want to, and figure out why is that and how do I reach that student. It's an incredibly, I think I've used this word before, but it's artisanal. It is something you learn. It's an art form to be able to look into the eyes of a kid and say, oh, you're not here with me right now. Let me
reach
out to
you. So what do you
do
about it? You got 34 other people who say are getting it, and this one person is not. He's just not engaged. He or she is not engaged.
Yeah.
You can't stop and ignore the other 34. What do you do?
So every day is a little different. There's no one strategy to say, oh, well, let me, you know, do this. I'll do X this time. It really is individually about that kid, knowing that child. And so this year I had a student who very clearly from day one I could tell was going to be he loved to be oppositional. He just loved to argue, loved to fight. And so if you say, you know, hey, Shakespeare, you know, thought this, he would immediately go, well, how do you know? He's dead, you know. And so you've got to tap into that. You could tell he just loved that. And so you challenge him. You go ahead and let him argue and enjoy the argument and show him that you're not afraid to be challenged and that you enjoy discussion and that you, and he very quickly realized, oh, he's not mad at me for arguing. He's not angry. He's not going to oppose me. He actually is excited that I'm questioning and saying, well, how do you know that? And then giving me evidence. And so it took me about, I would say, 2 weeks before he finally started really having fun arguing with me, and now he's absolutely one of my favorite students. He sits in the very front row and is the first one every time to.
It's very collegiate level.
Yeah. It is.
That's what I was an English minor. That's what we did. We took issue with the teacher, and because I was a terrible English minor. Because my question was all, how do you know the poet's intent there?
Exactly.
I don't see that. How do you know?
Exactly.
And I would say that, and it would not go over well.
Well, that's the issue, is that's exactly the kind of question we want. That's, you know, it's that's the beauty of literature and understanding is, okay, well, we're trying to figure out what a poet who's been dead for 400 years thought. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? And we do that in a almost scientific discovery sort of way. We look for evidence. We look at the time period. We look at the biography. We look at everything, and we come up with our best idea. Does it mean we're right? Of course not. It means this is the best we've got. This is what we think. And that's, kids can get into that and get excited about it, but that takes a lot of confidence as a teacher.
Can you do that and teach to the test at the same time? Because that takes time. Allow that argument to take place, get you off your lesson plan.
I've never taught to a test. The truth is that good teaching is good teaching, and it's the test is on our curriculum, and our curriculum in my class is, like I said, it's literature, it's reading, it's interpretation. At the end of grade on my test, they will read difficult, challenging passages and be asked interpretive questions about those. And so I can teach that in a way that's interesting and dynamic, and they question and they think, and the curriculum is still getting through in that, but I've never drilled test questions or done any of those things. And I found that often the teachers who have the very highest test scores, when I talk to them about what they do, go, oh no, I've never taught to the test. This is what I teach. I want them interested. And so that's the danger, though, of training teachers with a test mindset, this idea of testing. Instead, you need to think of it as getting buy-in, creating relationships, and finding ways to reach kids.
Do they teach you that when you go to teacher's college, if you went to teacher's college? Is that
yes,
what
they teach you? They that? Do, absolutely. I had great instructors. I went to Florida State University College of Education, and that's what I was taught. It was a lot about how to reach students and how to build curriculum and how to teach in a way that is dynamic to the needs of kids. It is student-centered, and that is largely what we're doing in our colleges of education in North Carolina now. We're looking at student-centered learning. What do the kids need, and how do you reach those needs, just like your English teacher you described?
One of the things that teachers of the year get to do, and you got to do in 2016, and you're going to a meeting as soon as this show is over, mm-hmm. is that you get to observe and I think participate in and advise on policy at the state level.
That's right.
And I suppose maybe you get to do that now at the national level because you're named the best teacher of 2018.
Right.
What are your thoughts on what you observed in those opportunities that you had to sit in and watch these policies being formulated?
I never fully grasped how incredibly complicated the field of policy and education is. I'm the teacher advisor to the state board, so the board meeting is actually going on right now, and I'm going to drive straight to Raleigh after this interview and join that. And so I'll actually sit on the board as their advisor, and I have a microphone and get to speak when a policy comes up that I feel strongly about. But when you start talking about education policy at, say, a state level, you have to realize that it's not just about education. It's about economics, and it's about, you know, engineering and technical fields as well, and it's about all of these really complicated things coming together. And so it was easy to just be in my field of education and think, oh, well, this policy affects me as a teacher. It should be this way. And once you get into, you know, things like the legislature, you realize they're on five committees or seven committees that are transportation and education and agriculture and business. And each one of those policies affects the other. And so it's a much bigger and more complex answer than anything I realized. And that's why, as I've moved forward in my career now, and I've gotten quite a few connections and a lot of influence in the field, I realized that my best work is to focus on the thing I know best, which is classroom teaching mm-hmm. and schools, and not to worry about, you know, what's happening in these other fields, we have good people who are working on those.
But it impacts you. And those who don't have, who haven't had the opportunity to sit in on these meetings and participate in these meetings might think, and I'm putting words in thousands of teachers' mouths
right.
Might think that there's too much policy and not enough about teaching.
I think that can be the case often. There are times when policy gets in the way of good teaching, especially as we talked about with standardized teaching and standardized testing, and as well with the difficulty of recruiting teachers right now. We're having a very hard time getting young people to become teachers.
Why do you think that is? Is it strictly money?
It's not strictly money. It's not just money.
Is it
money
respect?
Money is definitely part of it. Respect is definitely part of it.
Is it the fact that people don't regard teaching as a profession anymore?
That's what we're hearing from young teachers, is that they don't see it as a long-term career. That's difficult to answer. On the one hand, there is obviously not an enormous amount of growth in your field if you're a teacher starting today. It's very hard to grow as a teacher. If you want to grow in the field of education, you have to leave the classroom, become an administrator, or move up into the county office or the state offices, or move into a larger field of education. Within the classroom, as a classroom teacher, most people are shocked with the success I've had that I'm still in the classroom.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because most of the, that's hard to say. Many times, let's say it that way, many times teachers who are awarded Teacher of the Year and the other accolades that you have been awarded because of your teaching skill take that year off that the Teacher of the Year gets and goes to these policy meetings and suddenly decides, I'm not going to be in the classroom
right.
anymore. I'm either going to be an administrator, or I'm going to be a consultant,
right.
or I'm going to find another more lucrative way to make money. My teaching days are now over. You did not make that decision. You're still in the classroom. Why?
It was tempting. What tempts you away from the classroom is not more money or, this higher up position. What tempts you away is the ability to influence education. When they look at you and say, hey, we can put you in a position that you become one of those policymakers, or you become someone who can influence education on the whole. And that's very tempting as a teacher to say, oh, well, I could have this impact.
Why do they want to take the best teacher and pull them out of the classroom? They've just given you this big award, and now they're saying, come be one of us.
Right.
Get out of the classroom.
Well,
you
have a unique perspective that many people in policy do not have. I'm often the only classroom teacher in the room in
Why?
Most of these
Why
policy
Why do they just
decision
invite
making.
More classroom teachers?
Oh, I would love that. I would love a room full of classroom teachers and just one politician, but typically that's not the way it works. But I'll often be the only classroom teacher, but the reason I have that perspective is because I'm a classroom teacher. And if I were to leave teaching, how much longer is that expertise going to stick around when I've been out 5-10 years? If I have a lot of the credibility I have is because I'm still in the classroom. And so when I drive up to Raleigh later this afternoon and I speak as someone who just taught in the classroom yesterday.
Can you conceive of a time when you will not be in the classroom, when you'll want to do something else, whether it's in education or outside of education?
Absolutely, I can. Right now, there are still things in the classroom I want to achieve. There are still things that I'm working on as a teacher. But I think down the road, life is long, I hope. And down the road, absolutely, I could see myself doing something else. But for right now, the classroom is where I want to be.
What keeps you going back every day? Is it the fresh challenge? How do you keep it fresh, first of all? Because you're teaching essentially the same subject, although it's different every time you teach it, I'm sure. But what keeps you going back? What is the foundation of this passion that you have for public education? And let's underline public.
Right. I think the strength of public education is the fact that it's public. That's what makes it great. That is why I do it and why I believe in it, that every single kid in my community has access to great teachers and great schools, and that's why I keep doing it. I have two young daughters who are school age in the town I teach in, and I want them to have great teachers, and so I want to be one of those. I want to stay in the classroom because I want to make sure that our best teachers don't leave to go do something else. We need great people in the room.
But last time you were here, you said something that stuck in my head. You said there is no growth in teaching, and that's one of the problems.
It is.
In other words, you can move up to be a principal or a superintendent or something like that. But if you're a classroom teacher, there's no place to go.
Yeah, it is. It's very frustrating.
Can that be changed?
Absolutely, it can.
How?
So we have, right now, there are 6 pilot programs in North Carolina to look at how to change that, to create, for example, growth within the classroom, like create a teacher leader, a teacher who could train younger teachers, for example, and maybe teach a hybrid schedule, maybe teach 2 classes a day and then use my other 2 periods to coach other teachers. Or maybe there's a system by which I would do direct instruction and have almost like apprentices who do other parts of my teaching as well. And so there's a lot of different systems being tried right now, but I think North Carolina has recognized that we need to create some growth for teachers, good teachers, who want to stay in the classroom. Because as it is, I am very lucky that I have my hardworking and talented and brilliant wife who brings in our primary income, and so it allows me to not have to chase money and leave the classroom. I'm incredibly lucky that way, but not every teacher can make that choice.
Yeah. We're going to talk about money in a second here. Brent on Facebook wants to know, would you ever consider taking your talents to a Title I school to teach non-AP students? Why or why not?
Yeah, I would absolutely love that challenge. For me, because of my young family, I really love where I am. I'm teaching in the district where my children go to school. They're in the feeder schools that come into my school. So I love my community, and I really like where I teach. And so that's an exciting challenge. I started in that area, but it is something I think about.
Bobby Kavnar is a teacher at South Point High School in Belmont, and he's the nation's best teacher for 2018. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're having our second conversation in 2 years with Bobby Kavnar. In 2016, he joined us because he was the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. This year, he was named Best Teacher in the Nation by the NEA. I guess that was that the National Education Association, is what the NEA stands for?
That's right, yeah.
And he is a British literature teacher and the chair of the English department at South Point High School in Belmont. You, I'm told, do your class assignments in calligraphy. Is that
right.
True still?
It is.
Mike emails, why is cursive writing no longer, much less calligraphy, why is cursive writing no longer taught? My 6th grader cannot sign his name. Many parents and grandparents are appalled by this.
Well, he'll be thrilled to know that it is by law now taught in every school in North Carolina. The legislators passed a bill, I want to say a year or two ago, that requires cursive writing be taught in elementary schools again. It's my shtick. It serves really no purpose other than I'm a character, and the kids. One of my best teacher friends and I always say that teaching is 1/4 preparation and 3/4 pure drama.
Yeah.
You have to. You're an actor every
you're
time you get on.
Yes.
Yeah, you're performing, and so when I stand up there in my bow tie in my dusty classroom and draw out my instructions on the board in calligraphy, they just adore it. Yeah.
Let's talk about that, because that's very artsy, and you believe in arts education.
Absolutely.
We live in a world where STEM education has taken center stage, science, technology, engineering, and math, and we live in a time when if what's being taught cannot lead somebody directly to a job, there seems to be no value at all to it, and yet you assert and continue to assert the importance of arts and humanities education in the public schools.
Absolutely.
Why?
I think we are heading right now as a nation towards a large pushback on that incredible focus on STEM. While I do not disagree with the focus on STEM. I think STEM is vital. STEM is science, technology, engineering, mathematics. These are the things that continue to move us forward as a nation and continue to drive medicine and our inventive spirit. But at the same time, we as a nation are moving to a period where we seem to lack all empathy. We seem to not be able to listen to each other and understand each other. And we are dividing ourselves more and more. And you know, here in Charlotte, we have a real issue with communities dividing themselves, segregating themselves. And the arts, things like what I do with storytelling, things like reading Beowulf and understanding why a Viking from 1,000 years ago has things to teach us today, the arts are how we tell our stories to each other, and it's how we learn to see ourselves in other people and to share those moments with each other.
And to understand their experience.
We read diverse writers because we learn that they have the same fears and the same thoughts and the same desires that we have. And we all want a safe and valuable and fruitful world for our children. That's what we all want. We want this society, but we tend to think other people have bad intentions in what they want. And by reading each other's stories, we can understand each other better and learn that empathy.
But even with all this focus on STEM, people don't believe scientists. They don't understand science. They don't think it's true.
Yeah, it's again that empathy, though. See, the issue here is not necessarily that they don't understand the science, because frankly, I am not a scientist. I don't understand the science always, but I trust that scientist, my brother is a cellular biologist, I trust that he is a trustworthy person, that he has the best intentions, that he knows what he's doing, that he's done that work, and that when he says it's true, I can trust him. And that's something that is vital to, you know, the news. Do you trust this source or not? And we as a society are losing empathy for each other, trust for each other. And so there's so much doubt and so much fear and so much mistrust that we just don't know who to trust anymore. And a lot of that is going to have to come through the arts.
And you have said that you see teachers as the equalizers, the keepers of America's promise of equal opportunity. But to public schools, can public schools, are they able to be the equalizers and providers of equal opportunity anymore?
I believe so. We are more successful now in North Carolina public schools than we've ever been in our history. We are graduating more students than ever before. More kids are going to college than ever before. More kids are being successful.
Are they ready when they graduate?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. We've seen a large decline, in fact, in students who need remediation in college after they come out of high school and things like that. We also are offering in North Carolina public schools great opportunities besides college. We're offering technical and dual enrollment and a lot of options for kids that we didn't used to in the past. It used to be kind of one pathway. You were either college bound or you weren't. And now we're looking at a lot of choice for North Carolina students in the public system. And many, many of my students are dual enrolled in a community college and at school at the same time.
There's a lot of pressure on the public schools. There's a lot of expectations on the public schools and on public school teachers. We put a lot of things that have nothing to do with education.
Absolutely.
On the public schools. And at the same time, we don't seem to want to pay very much for public school teachers. Right now, every single teacher in the public schools in West Virginia is on strike. It's
That's
an
right.
illegal strike, according to the state. But they rank 48th out of 50 for teacher pay. They average, I think, $45,000 a year, which I thought was reasonable, particularly in West Virginia, which is not Manhattan. It's the cost of living there is lower, but they say that that's not enough. That's the median salary. It's not enough that a lot of the teachers there are working two jobs and they're on food stamps.
Yes.
And that's not acceptable. So the state has offered them a 2% raise this year, and 2 years from now, they'll offer them a 1% raise, and then the following year, they'll offer them a 1% raise, and they're saying, that's not enough. And this is happening all over the country. Not the strike, but this conversation about low teacher pay.
Yeah.
What do we do about that?
I think we need to look at what's required of teachers today. I mean, I have a teacher in my hall who is a PhD in mathematics and teaches calculus for college-bound students. And then we're offering a salary that is just not competitive with what she could be earning anywhere else with that sort of credibility and credentials. And
so can we afford her? Because everything has a cost-benefit ratio.
Absolutely.
Now. All the MBAs got involved in this. Can we afford her?
Well, we're going to pay for it one way or the other. We're going to pay for it either by losing out on the great minds coming out of our high schools. And we look at businesses looking at Charlotte, and they're saying, we need more talent. We need more talent coming out of your schools. And so it's an investment. It's an investment like every other one that we say, we need talent coming out of North Carolina schools. How do we do that? Well, we invest in these teachers who are credentialed, licensed, master's and doctorate degree holding professionals, just like every other profession, but we aren't paying them anywhere near what you could make anywhere else.
Do you think public schools are supported by and large by the public, first of all, secondly, by politicians and policymakers, or do you feel that public education is under attack?
You know, 2 years ago, I would have said public education is under attack, and I think in just the last 2 years, if you look nationwide, there is a shift happening. I think teachers and parents and people who are in education, who actually see what's happening in the schools, realize great things are happening in our schools. And we are starting to get that word out. But I think we were behind in public education with sort of advertising what we do. We've never had to advertise before. And now we're realizing that's part of it. We got to market ourselves. We have to show off the great things we're doing. And we're getting better at that.
But do people believe it? Because the public schools have gotten such a bad rap, and you have this situation of white flight, where parents take their kids out of public school and stick them in private school. You have this rise of charter schools, which although are private, they operate under a different set of standards and a different set of
rules.
Right,
although they're public, yeah.
Although they're public schools. Do you think people believe that the public schools are any good? I mean, we keep touting CMS in this market as being one of the bright and shining beacons of public education in the country, and people here going, Pah!
Yeah, again, I think that's about image. When I bring people into my school, for example, they often are shocked by the things we're doing. They don't realize that we have these magnificent, you know, science labs going on, and they're looking at the experiments happening and going, wow, this is a public school? Yes. It's about image. And so the teachers in those charter schools, I'm friends with those teachers. They're great teachers, but they're the same people we are. They're the same degree-holding, you know, professionals, and they're going to realize, I think, eventually that we have great things to offer. But we're behind in showing that off.
Well, you've called public schools the great equalizer, and I'm just curious how that can be. Our frame of reference here, obviously, you teach in Belmont. Our frame of reference here is CMS.
Sure.
We have these pockets of poverty that we're trying to deal with, and we have the resegregation of our schools, which has led to great inequities in terms of resources and physical plant and even teachers who don't want to be in certain schools. They'd rather be in Ballantyne. Mm-hmm. How can you be the great equalizer if your schools aren't equal?
That is absolutely the greatest challenge we're facing is equal access. The equality of access is what we as a state need to focus on. Access to great teachers, for example. We keep seeing that high-scoring teachers tend to leave low-performing schools and move to other schools. And we sort of view it as, oh, well, they worked their way out. And that is absolutely poisonous to the promise of public education, the idea that anywhere you go, you're going to get a great access to quality educators and quality teaching. And how we address that is one of the big challenges. It's why the State Board of Education just added equal access to their state plan. That needs to be a major focus of how we move forward.
In your speech to the NEA Foundation when they gave you the award, you said the strength of the public schools has always been and will continue to be that they are public. Why is that so important?
If we want our children to be able to thrive and prosper in a society as diverse as ours, then we need to give them diverse experiences from childhood. We need them to be able to work with people from all different races and creeds and beliefs and be able to have truly diverse experiences. When they come out of school, if they went to a school that was segregated in the way you're describing, they'll never have had that beautiful experience of working in the world that is as diverse as our nation is. Our nation is not a segregated nation. We are a diverse population. And so that is the strength of public schools. We offer something that truly prepares kids for the real world and isn't just about who they chose to surround themselves with.
Let's just spend a few seconds talking about safety in the schools. 17 people, students and teachers, were shot and killed at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Lakeland, Florida. You taught there.
I did.
Your first year in teaching. What was your reaction when you heard this?
Obviously, it's heartbreaking. It is something that every one of these attacks on a school affects teachers personally. We imagine our own children and the kids that sit in front of us every day, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. I wrote a piece that there's a letter on my website, bobbykavner.com, that explains, I think, practical things that we can do.
We only have a couple of minutes, but let's talk about that, because you wrote this piece in the Gaston Gazette called What Must Change to Save Our Schools from Violence, and you've said that we've lost a sense of community to the point where there is no center to hold. And in that article, you talked about looking through yearbooks, old yearbooks, and comparing those schools then to schools today. What did you discover?
Schools today, for one thing, are incredibly big nationwide. This isn't just about North Carolina, my piece, but I taught at Stoneman Douglas during my student teaching, and then I went to work for a school that had...
That appears to be a big school. They have a freshman building.
About 3,000 students. I think it's 10 or 12 buildings, and that's not unusual for South Florida. I taught at a school that had almost 5,000 students.
Okay.
We had 70 portable classrooms, and these schools are so large that it's very difficult to know the children. It's difficult to know their parents and know that community and get them the services they need, because we just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because it's cheaper to do it that way. But if you look back at older schools, for one thing, they were built almost like castles. There was one door that you went in, but they were also just smaller. They were much, much smaller, where you as a teacher in that school often saw the same faces year after year and got to know those kids.
And they got to know you. The teachers could afford to live in the community. People saw them on the streets, in the grocery stores, et cetera. You talk about how now we're sharing one nurse to four schools, where they used to be in one school, and the kids got to know the nurses, and more importantly, the nurses
got to know the kids
and the family situation and what was driving them. Ann Doss Helms, the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, asked me to ask you this question. It's very quick. She says, I'm sure that when she was out at your school, she saw a doorframe metal detector at South Point High. There's something CMS doesn't use. It doesn't appear to be active. It didn't that day. Just pushed off to the side. Does it make you feel, or the students feel, safer? Very quickly.
It's difficult. The way our campus is built, we have dozens of outside doors, but we are right now working very hard to keep security in mind. We've installed things like cameras at the front of the school that you have to buzz in, but it is something we need to redesign schools.
Bobby Kavnar, the 2016 Teacher of the Year in North Carolina and the 2018 Best Teacher in the Nation from South Point High in Belmont. Thanks for the hour.